In the last session, we talked about the law of their mind. Paul was saying in Romans 7, I don't understand what I do. The things I want to do, I don't do. The things I don't want to do, I keep on doing. You get down to the end of that chapter and he says, who will rescue me from this body of death? And he gives the answer, thanks be to God through Jesus Christ our Lord. So then, I myself in my mind am a slave to God's law. But in the sinful nature, a slave to the law of sin. But he talked about the law of the mind. And I want to talk about the psychodynamics of behavior, or the law of the mind. I want us to look at a biblical viewpoint of psychology. In order to do that, we're going to need to look at some information from our friend Sigmund Freud. Now, we've talked about this in a previous session. Sometimes I find that Christians have a difficult time with Freud because so many of his ideas were so ungodly and so unbiblical. But yet, like a broken watch can be right twice a day, someone like Freud is able, through general revelation, to arrive at some very helpful understandings of how life works. And as he studied the mind, he came across some very, I think, important information. We looked at the id in a previous session. But right now, in this session, we're going to look at what he talked about, the id, the ego, and the superego. But before we get to that, we're going to talk about what he referred to as the different levels of the mind. And what you might want to do is draw a large rectangle or box as we label the levels of the mind. And the first section probably maybe occupying 10% of that box, we're going to refer to as the conscious awareness. The conscious awareness. Now, what is the conscious awareness? The conscious awareness is the here and now. As in any environment, you're consciously aware of those around you. You're consciously aware of the temperature of the room. You're consciously aware whether you're interested or bored, etc. The conscious awareness, the here and now. Animals have conscious awareness. You walk through the woods and you'll see the squirrels noticing you and scampering up trees. My dog has conscious awareness. My dog understands when someone's in the house. Conscious awareness, the here and now. Now, draw about another 20% of that box in the next section, and we're going to call that the preconscious. Now, that's going to leave you something like about 70% remaining inside of that box. We'll talk about that in a moment. But the next level of the mind, right below the conscious awareness that Freud talked about, was called the preconscious. The preconscious. Now, what's a way of describing the preconscious? The preconscious is the short-term memory. Oftentimes, I ask people when I'm talking about this, what did you have for breakfast yesterday morning? Or better yet, what did you have for breakfast 2 days ago? Because the preconscious material stays there about 48 to 96 hours. And people will begin to give me a description of what they had for breakfast 2 days ago. If this is Friday, I'll ask what you have for breakfast on Wednesday. If it's Wednesday, I'll ask what you have for breakfast on Monday, etc. And they can usually tell me. And I'll ask them for details. And they'll be amazed at the number of details that they can arrive at. Typically, the people will say, well, I don't remember. But if you press them a little bit, they'll begin to remember what they had for breakfast, who was around them, what color was the bowl, etc., etc., etc. Usually with many details, but the longer it goes, the more of those details that seem to evaporate. The question is, do they really evaporate? Many people believe that they do not evaporate, but they're stored in the subconscious. That's 70%, the subconscious. Or another way of looking at that is long-term memory. And many psychologists have postulated that everything that has ever happened to us is stored in our mind. It's not always easily retrievable, but it is stored there in the subconscious. What is that subconscious? Well, a definition that you could write in that box is a vast storehouse of memory and something that we're going to talk about in a few moments. A vast storehouse of memory and something that we're going to talk about in a few moments. Really, the study of psychology is the study of conscious awareness, preconscious and subconscious. But you know, there's both animal psychology and there's human psychology. What makes a difference? Does my Labrador Retriever have conscious awareness? Well, of course he does. He's very, very conscious of what's going on. Does my Labrador Retriever have short-term memory? He must, or you'd forever have to teach him new things. Does my Labrador Retriever have a subconscious or a storehouse of memory and meaning? Well, if he didn't, he'd have to be retrained every 96 hours. So, my Labrador Retriever has conscious awareness, preconscious, and subconscious. Does that make my Labrador Retriever just like me? Well, what else is it? It's a vast storehouse of memory and meaning. See, we human beings have to give meaning to everything that happens to us. Being created in the image of God, we evaluate everything. And we're going to talk in a few moments how we evaluate. Now, does my Labrador Retriever have the ability to evaluate? Does my Labrador Retriever have the ability to arrive at different meanings from different events? I would suggest he certainly does. I see it every morning. See, I get up about 4:30 every morning, and I go through my workout routine prior to doing daily devotions. And that means I'm going down in my basement about 5 o'clock in the morning to get on a Stairmaster and do a workout on Stairmaster and lift weights, etc. My lab sleeps in the basement. And when I go downstairs, what does my lab do? Nothing, nothing, absolutely nothing. He sort of lifts his head, puts it back down, and does nothing. Now, my wife, on the other hand, is getting up around 6 o'clock, and she's going to be doing her workout later. But I'm downstairs, and as soon as that dog hears movement upstairs, that dog is over to the steps, looking up at the door, wagging his tail. Now, why is that? Why does the dog do nothing when I come downstairs, yet when he hears my wife's noises upstairs, he goes over and stands at the door and wags his tail? Well, maybe you've already guessed it, but the answer is, it's because my wife is going to feed that dog. That dog has made meaning of that event. The meaning of the event of me coming downstairs means absolutely nothing to the dog because he's not getting anything out of it. The meaning of my wife, though, moving around in the morning means that he's about to get fed. And he's a Labrador Retriever, which means he's real interested in that happening. So, does that mean there's no difference between humans and animals in the way we think? No, I would like to suggest that there's a huge difference. Because there's something that I know and you know and every human being from an early age knows that my Labrador Retriever does not know. And what I know and you know is that we're going to die. We know that from an early age. And the book of Ecclesiastes says God has set eternity in the hearts of man. So what is in that subconscious? that subconscious is a vast storehouse of memory and eternal meaning. We have to evaluate life's meaning in the view of eternity. Whether we want to admit to that or not, whether we are a Christian or whether we reject Christianity, it occurs anyway. We evaluate life according to our eternal meaning. And that's what creates our beliefs that are located in that subconscious. Now, Freud also talked about the three functions of the mind, the id, the ego, and the superego. The id, the ego, and the superego. We've already referred to the id. So on the top of that box, maybe you'd want to write id on the left, ego in the middle, and superego on the right. Now, the way Freud described the id, as we've already talked about, is very, very similar to the way the Apostle Paul described the old sin nature, or the flesh, in Ephesians and elsewhere as we looked at the old sin nature. We just talked about it in Romans chapter 7, where he says that the things I want to do, I don't do. The things I don't want to do, I keep on doing, etc., etc. Who will deliver me from this body of death, that old man? Now, Freud said that there was also a function of the mind that he called the superego. Others have referred to that as the human conscience. I like to refer to that as the umpire. The umpire. What does an umpire do? Well, the umpire calls balls and strikes, says whether you're safe or out, etc., etc. What does he use to make those calls? He uses the rule book, and he gets that rule book from the authorities. We have gotten a rule book, and here's biblical psychology in one verse. As a man believes in his heart, so is he. Or as a man believes within himself, so is he. You see, we have all kinds of beliefs in our conscious awareness, our preconscious, and our subconscious. But located in our subconscious is these things called heart beliefs. And I suggest you draw heart down there in the subconscious and label it heart beliefs. And what are those? Those are our nuclear beliefs, our core beliefs, our beliefs about ourself as a person. And you see, those beliefs can either be true or false, facilitating or debilitating beliefs. But they are there, and they are our core beliefs. And our beliefs about our worth as a person is what creates those heart beliefs. The superego, our human conscience, is developed from those heart beliefs. And that umpire is going to operate according to the rule book that he is given. And most of us, the rule book that we have been given is that rule book that operates from the formula that says my worth is based on my performance plus others' opinions. So, what have I got so far? I've got the conscious awareness, which is the here and now, the preconscious, which is short-term memory, and the subconscious, which is long-term memory, or a vast storehouse of memory and eternal meaning. If you think of your mind as a computer, you can think of the conscious awareness as the computer screen. Now, you can get a fair amount of information on the computer screen. But can't you get a whole lot more information on a disk than what you can get on the screen at any one time? And that disk would represent your preconscious or your short-term memory. But you can get a whole lot more information on that hard drive. And that is what is referred to as the subconscious or long-term memory or vast storehouse of memory and eternal meaning. Now, that information that's on this computer screen is very easily accessible. doesn't take much skill at all to get to. But information stored on a disk requires a little more skill. And, quite honestly, information stored on the hard drive may require a greater level of skill. In fact, sometimes you have to call in an expert to help you retrieve that. In fact, in my house, sometimes I have to ask my 15-year-old son to get it for me, our computer expert. Well, you see, everything that's ever happened to us is located down there in that hard drive. And not only has it happened to us, and not only is it stored there, but it also affects us. Because it's all of those events, all of those memories, that have led us to developing those heart beliefs. And once again, what did the writer of Proverbs say? As a man believes in his heart, so is he. Or as a man believes within himself, so is he. And then we've described the id and the superego. The id being the flesh, and this old sin nature, the child part of us. The superego being the parent, the moral authority, our human conscience, our umpire. Well, what about that thing called the ego? What is that? Well, you know, if I were to say, boy, John sure has a lot of ego, typically the way we would think about that is we would probably say, well, John really thinks a lot about himself. He's probably really conceited, etc. He's on an ego trip, what have you. And that's typically the way we think of ego, which is absolutely not what we're talking about in this instance. Absolutely not what we're talking about this instance. The purpose of the ego is to be a negotiator between the id and the superego. It negotiates by utilizing what's known as ego defense mechanisms. I'll describe how that works in a moment. So maybe what you would like to do right now is draw a box on that heart belief. And we're going to label that the ego meter. Now that ego meter works exactly like the breaker box on your house. How much current does a nuclear power plant put out? I don't know, a bunch. But your coffee pot works on 110 volts. Now what has to happen? That power that the nuclear power plant has to get into a form that can be utilized in your coffee maker. So it goes through a series of reducers, and it reduces it down, and it goes out to the high-tension wires. And probably each wire and the high-tension wire carry, for sake of argument, say 50,000 volts. And then it comes out to the wires under your street or overhead, and those wires carry maybe 4,000 or 5,000 volts. And then it comes to the service entrance at your house, and when it gets to the service entrance of your house, maybe it's coming in at 440. And it goes into the breaker box at your house, and at the breaker box it gets divided out again, and it goes to some circuits at 220 and most of the circuits at 110. Now, what happens to a circuit that's designed to get hit with 110 if it gets hit with 220 or 440? Well, it'll burn out the wires. But it doesn't do that because it flips the breaker and it shuts down the system. It's a protective mechanism. It's sort of like that with the ego meter. The main purpose of the ego is to make sure that you will only feel but just so bad about yourself as a person. In fact, when we say that someone has low ego strength, what we're saying is that they may feel so bad about themselves that they might very well be suicidal. And the main purpose of the ego function of your mind is to serve as a negotiator between the id and the superego. So let's think about this for a moment. Let's think about someone who is either in recovery or certainly should be in recovery. And we're going to call that person John. And John has a problem. John went out last night and he really got drunk. I mean, he tied one on. And he went home and poured himself into bed about 2 o'clock in the morning. Now, his alarm clock went off at 5:30 saying it's time to get up and get to work. John's alarm went off and he woke up and he feels horrible. He feels rotten. He does not want to go into work. So what happens? Well, he has something going on. He's got this id, this flesh, that says, take care of me. I don't feel good. Just go back to sleep. Forget everything. He's got this super ego that saying, well, you really need to get up and go to work. You really need to get up and go to work. So he negotiates between them. And he comes up with a plan. He calls down to his wife, Mary, and he says, Mary, call in and tell him I'm sick. Tell him I can't make it to work today. What John doesn't know is that he's living with a different Mary than he's lived with in the past. Because Mary has always done that for him in the past, but she's not going to do it for him today. Why? Well, Mary's been going to Freedom Ministries, and she's been going to a recovery group on codependency. It's called Boundaries. And in that, she's learned that helping does not help. That when I stand between the addict and the logical consequences of their behavior, and I rescue them from the logical consequences of their behavior, then the addict never has any kind of motivation for change. Because remember, we always see the light when we feel the heat. What motivates us to change? If we're comfortable, we don't change. We only change when we experience discomfort. That discomfort will either come from the Holy Spirit in a gentle way, or if we refuse to respond, then God has to turn up the heat and let experiences bring about that discomfort. So Mary has decided that she's no longer going to call in for John. But you know what? She probably still maybe have to deal with some of her false beliefs, like those who fail are unworthy of love and deserve to be punished. And maybe she wants to get a little vengeance. So she gets right up in his ear and she goes, John, you drink too much. Now, what automatically just happened there? Well, he got some input. So you can draw an ear on the side of your box. And he got input into that ear, and it immediately passed through his conscious awareness down into his preconscious and into his subconscious, and it hit his heart belief. And he had a heart belief that says, I must perform to a certain standard in order to have worth as a person. Now, we know that's a false belief, but it is his heart belief. It's at his core. What does reality tell John about his performance? His reality tells him that his performance does not make the grade, does not meet a standard. Now, since his worth is riding on his performance, that is too much for him to take. So it goes and flips the ego meter, just like the breaker box on the house, shuts down the circuit, and out comes what's known as an ego defense mechanism. An ego defense mechanism is a thought or a behavior that is designed to mitigate the previous thought, or the thought that says, because you're not performing, you're no good. So he comes up with a brilliant response that says something like this. Oh, no, I don't. Oh, no, I don't. That's what's called denial. Have you ever heard the phrase, you know, denial ain't a river in Egypt? No, denial is not a river in Egypt. Well, what is denial? Well, denial is an ego defense mechanism whereby the individual deals with emotional conflicts or internal or external stressors by refusing to acknowledge some aspect of external reality that would be apparent to everyone else. They just refuse to see them. They refuse to acknowledge them. They just put their blinders over their eyes and refuse to acknowledge some aspect of reality that is apparent to everyone else. That's denial. For recovery to occur, denial must be defeated. Or perhaps he doesn't do that. Perhaps he jumps up and he throws his shoes against the wall or breaks a mirror or does something seriously foolish like that. Maybe even hits her. What's that? That's called acting out. The individual deals with emotional conflicts or internal or external stressors by acting without reflection or apparent regard for negative consequences. You know, people who act without thinking? Well, actually, no one acts without thinking, but the thinking process occurs so rapidly that it appears as if they're acting without thinking. Or how about this one? Yeah, I guess I do drink too much, but you know what? I'll have a pickled liver and leave a good-looking corpse and you'll be a rich young widow. What is that? A real poor attempt at what's called humor. The individual deals with emotional conflicts or internal external stressors by emphasizing the amusing or ironic aspects of the conflict or stressor. You know people who make a joke out of everything? In fact, if you'll study comedians, what you'll find is that many, many famous, really funny comedians have led really painful lives. And I think many of them have learned to compensate and to get along with life by making a joke out of everything. Or maybe you say something like this, well, anybody drink too much if they were married to an old battle axe like you. That's called rationalization. The individual deals with emotional conflicts or internal or external stressors by devising reassuring or self-serving but incorrect explanations for his or her or own other's behavior. I just tell myself a lie. I rationalize. I make up something. It's reassuring. It's self-serving, but it's incorrect. Or maybe this one. Oh, I'm so sick. I'm so sick. You see this brown spot on my arm? It's got to be cancer. It must be cancer. That one's called somatization. The individual deals with emotional conflicts, internal, external stressors by preoccupation with physical symptoms which are disproportionate to any actual physical disturbance. You know people who are sick all the time? Or there's suppression and repression. In repression, the individual deals with emotional conflicts, internal external stressors, by being unable to remember or being cognitively aware of disturbing wishes, feelings, thoughts, or experiences. It's just like I don't have the ability to find that information. Or there's suppression. The individual deals with emotional conflicts or internal external stressors by intentionally avoiding thinking about disturbing problems, wishes, feelings, or experiences. You may hear something said, well, we don't really talk about those kinds of things in our family. I don't want to think about that. You know, sort of like the Scarlett O'Hara way of dealing with stress. Or maybe he does go to work. Maybe he does go to work. And when he gets to work, his boss walks in and he says, John, happen to notice you're late again today. And you know what, John? This is only the 15th of the month, and you've been late this month 8 times. That's not a good record, John. Now, John, I think I know why you're late. I think you're late because you're drunk. Now, that might not be what you like to hear. Maybe you'd like to hear you're an alcoholic, but it doesn't matter. You're either alcoholic or drunk, but John, you drink too much. Now, John, I don't know why you drink. Maybe your mother was mean to you, your father never loved you, whatever. John, you know what? I really don't care why you drink. Because the bottom line is, John, you're here to do a day's work. And I'm paying you a day's wage, and I expect a day's work for that day's wage. Now, John, here's the deal. It's either my way or the highway. You're either going to do this job my way, come in sober, come in on time every day, or your history, John. You understand me? Your history. Now, how is John feeling right now? Probably pretty angry. But there's this thing called the superego that's telling him, you need this job, John, you need this job, don't do anything stupid. And he listens to it that time, and he swallows it. He swallows that anger, he doesn't say anything, he just internalizes it, and it eats at him. Until he goes home, and the minute he walks home, he yells at his wife, maybe even slaps her. She yells at the oldest kid, who hits the middle kid, who kicks the youngest kid, who kicks the dog, who bites the cat, who eats the canary. What is that? That's called displacement. What is displacement? Well, the individual deals with emotional conflicts, internal and external stressors, by generalizing or redirecting a feeling about or a response to an object onto another, usually a less threatening object. I just pass it along. Now, I've gone over about 7 or 8 different types of ego defense mechanisms. Mr. Freud thought of 16 of them, and you can find those in most any general psychology textbook. But there's another one that I've added. Mr. Freud never thought about it. I've always referred to it as number 17. But I haven't really come up with a good title for it. So far we're calling it false spirituality or over-religiosity. And it goes something like this. John goes, well, bless God, yes, it's been revealed to me that you're right and I drink too much. And you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go to church this Sunday. And I'm going to sit there in the pew. And when that pastor gives the invitation, I'm going to walk the aisle. And when I walk the aisle, I'm going to go down there and I'm going to shake hands with that pastor and we're going to go pray and God's going to zap me and I'm never going to drink again. Praise God. Now, would it be a good idea for John to go to church on Sunday? You betcha. Would it be a good idea for him to walk the aisle and ask somebody to pray for him? You betcha it would be. Is he going to? Probably not. It's a whole lot of mumbo jumbo. But even if he does, should we expect the zap? You see, that's the addict's way of handling life, to try to get relief and to get relief quickly. He's probably not going to do it, and if he's doing it, he's doing it with a false expectation. And that's why I call it false spirituality. Over religiosity, because it's a lot of talk and little action. No, recovery is a process. Salvation is an event. Recovery is a process. For by one sacrifice he has made perfect forever who? Those who are being made holy. So, those are the ego defense mechanisms, and that's how they operate. But that leaves us with a question, and the question is, why? Why do we use them? Well, some people would say, well, probably we use them because we're evil. And if we weren't just so evil, we wouldn't use them. Others would say, well, we're dumb. And if we were just a little bit more intelligent, we would not need them. Well, see, I don't think either of those are true. But I think there are two reasons that we use them. The first reason, I think, is because we're blind to them. We're blind to them because we've become so used to them. We probably learned them early in childhood, and we've continued using them, and we become blind to them, sort of like someone who has bad breath. I mean, do you ever have bad breath? Do you know when you have bad breath? Typically not. I mean, you might assume it, but you don't know it because you'll notice that your breath is real close to your nose, and since it's there all the time, it's normal to you. Do others around you know when you have bad breath? They certainly do. Now think about it. If you've got bad breath and don't know it, but someone around you does know it, would it be to your benefit if they would tell you about it? And quite honestly, that's what a lot of counseling is helping people become aware of their bad breath. Now, if you have bad breath and don't know it and somebody tells you about it, are you real happy to get the news? Sometimes people aren't real happy to get that news. Now, the purpose of giving the news is not to embarrass, but is to inform so as they can do something about it. But you know what? All of us are walking wounded. All of us are walking wounded. And oftentimes, when the truth comes, it just rubs up against that wound and we react rather than responding. And why is that? Well, I think the main reason we use these ego defense mechanisms is because we've been hurt so deeply, so often. In this world system that operates on the basis of self-worth equals my performance plus others' opinions, that they have become our only method of survival. Had we not used them, the wires would have burned out. The breaker box wouldn't have flipped the switch, shutting it down, and the wires would have burned out. And really, sometimes, some counselors will understand that and help you learn new ego defense mechanisms. Because after all, survival is all we can do, right? That's what we're after. Because if someone has low ego strength, they may be suicidal, so maybe what we'll do is teach them new ego defense mechanisms so that they can learn to cope, to compensate in life. But I'd like to suggest that there's a great wall of division there with Christian counseling. Because I know that Jesus did not say, "I came that you might have life and just muddle through somehow. I came that you might have life and just get by. I came that you might have life and just sort of survive." He did not say that. He said, "I came that you might have life and life more abundantly." Now, how do I get to that abundant life? How do I tap into that? Well, in order to do that, I have to ask the question, ask and answer the question, where do emotions come from? Where do emotions come from? Do situations cause emotions? And then emotions trigger behavior. Do situations cause emotions? We say it like this. He made me mad, so I hit him. He made me mad, so I hit him. Situation, he made me, emotion, mad, so I hit him, behavior. Do situations cause emotions? And usually I ask people to vote on that. You know, how many people think situations cause emotions? Raise your hands. How many people don't think that? Raise your hands. And those who refuse to give an answer, just sit there. Well, let's think about that. Let me give you a situation and three people who experience that situation. It's the middle of July and it's raining. There are three people, a Major League Baseball player, a farmer, and a 25-year-old single female office secretary. And I ask you to think about that. What are they feeling? And typically people would say that the farmer is happy, the ball player is sad, and the secretary is indifferent. So then I ask them, well, why did you come up with that idea? Well, the farmer's happy because his crops are getting watered. The ball player is sad because the ball game's being canceled, and the secretary's indifferent because it really doesn't matter to her one way or the other. But then I say, well, what if that farmer mowed hay yesterday? And you know, when you mow hay, you have to let it dry for a day before you bale it, because if you bale it too wet, you got problems, and if it gets rained on, you've got problems. You really need a couple days of dry weather to hay. Is he still happy? No, he's sad. But the situation hasn't changed. It's still middle of July and it's still raining. The ball player, you said he's sad because ball game's being canceled. But well, let's say it was Cal Ripken a few years ago when he was going for the most consecutive games, and he had a little hamstring pull that day that was going to keep him out of the lineup. But if the game's canceled, he's got a day off that he could rehab that leg and get back in the lineup, and his record's not broken. Is he sad? No, he's happy. But it's still raining outside and still middle of July. And that secretary who's indifferent just happened to have a picnic planned that day with this guy she's been dating for 9 months, who she heard had visited a jewelry store recently, and she thinks she's going to get a ring slipped on her finger at that outdoor romantic picnic for lunch today. Is she indifferent? I would suggest she's anything but indifferent. Well, what happened? Well, I would like to suggest that situations did not cause those emotions. Situations never produce emotions. But what I believe about the situation will produce a thought. The thought will trigger the emotion. The emotion will sponsor behavior. So false beliefs produce wrong thoughts, harmful emotions, and destructive behavior. That being true, the opposite is also true. Godly beliefs produce true thoughts, healthy emotions, and constructive behavior. So, situations never, ever, ever, ever cause emotions. But what I believe about it produces thoughts. The thoughts trigger the emotions. The emotions trigger behavior. That being true, that means there's good news and there's bad news. Good news and bad news. Which you want first, the good news or the bad news? Yes, I hear you. You want the bad news first. And the bad news is really bad. Since situations never, ever, ever cause emotions, what's the bad news? If it bugs me, it is my problem. If it bugs me, it is my problem. Situations never, ever, ever cause emotions. So if it bugs me, it is my problem. Meaning what? I am responsible. Now, are we people who typically embrace responsibility or avoid responsibility? When I say, he made me mad, what am I doing? Am I trying to take responsibility or avoid responsibility? Yes, I hear you saying avoid responsibility. That's exactly true. Anytime I say, he made me, I'm trying to avoid responsibility. But the reality is, I can't make you anything. I can't make you sad, I can't make you glad, I can't make you anything, because situations don't control emotions. So the bad news is, if it bugs you, it's your problem, not mine. If what I'm saying to you right now bugs you, it's your problem, not mine. Don't blame me, don't avoid responsibility. As a man believes within himself, so is he. As a man believes in his heart, so is he. Proverbs 23:7. If it bugs you, it's your problem. That's biblical cognitive behavioral therapy. If it bugs you, it's your problem. Now, is that bad news? Oh, yeah. That's bad news. I must take responsibility. I am responsible. Now you want the good news? As bad as the bad news was, the good news is even better. It is really, really good news. Do you want the good news? Well, in order to get the good news, you'll have to listen to the next session. Come back to the next session for the good news.